Arf! Puppacus here with The Dog Dish, a podcast all about puppy play and the humans behind the hoods. The conversation I'm going to share with you here in a minute took place on the 10th of April 2020 as a follow-up to some of the ideas that came up in the previous two episodes. To get a different take on the issue of consent, I interviewed Topher Chandler, aka Fuck You Topher, aka Mama's Pup Otter. He co-founded Florida Puppy Contest many years ago, and he's now the co-producer of Unity Leather and Fetish, an actively inclusive community group in the Tampa Bay area. I wanted to chat with Topher because anytime I discuss consent at events or in classes, he always has more he wants to say after the class or session has ended. His take on consent within pet play tends to go beyond the conversations we usually have, and I want to share his perspective with you. Some of what he says is potentially controversial, which is all the more reason to share it with you, to provoke discussion and consideration. As with everything we bark about on this show, you don't have to agree, but I do ask you to listen and consider. Now grab a chew toy, maybe find a comfy lap, and perk up your ears. Here's my conversation with Topher Chandler about consent in pet play. In our previous episode, I shared a conversation about the power of headspace. In that, we talked a bit about how negotiating with a critter needs to be done with thought and intention by asking simple binary questions, ensuring your tone matches the mood of what you're asking about, and stuff like that. We said that biological animals have pretty consistent and familiar ways of indicating yes, like a purr or wag or hopping or nuzzling or that sort of stuff. And indicating no, like a hiss, growl, evading things, swatting at you, throwing poo, all that jazz. Hey, we gotta include everybody. when human pets engage in play, those binary responses come naturally to us. And so human handlers and bystanders should pick up on those responses pretty easily. And I argued that humans should rely on those binary answers to ensure ongoing communication between the human and the pet. So with that little recap of the previous episode, have I already brought up something that you want to add on to or discuss for a bit?
I think one of the first things that we need to remember is 90% of the time when we're in a critter space, a pup space, a kitty space, or whatever, when we're in public, we're not necessarily on all fours. So we still have our front paws, our hands that we can use to continue to express emotions. And you don't have to know sign language, but there's some things that are pretty simple, like I need a drink of water, or I'm going to punch you in the teeth. Like, you can send really messages still without having to vocalize or communicate or rely on what we would consider a biological animal to do to get through to the humans or humans or whatever you want to call them, and sometimes to get through the drunks.
So it sounds to me like you're thinking of like bar environments and social casual environments as opposed to moshes and that sort of thing.
I think a lot of the environments in which we get to socialize as a larger community do take place in bars. They do take place in aspects where there's drinking. And I think that's where a lot of the issues actually stem from. For the sheer fact is if you go to a pup mosh or a critter mosh or a pony event, you're already have some expectation of the behaviors. You're going in knowing what environment you're walking into. So the communication is a lot easier because we have a semi-common language. When you're walking into a bar environment in which you have the non-kink or non-critter or AKA muggles there, it's a lot harder to communicate with them because they don't know the expectation or the requirements of dealing with a critter.
And one of the things that came up in conversation in the last episode was what happens when people have expectations of muggles to understand our signs and signals and that sort of thing, and that we need a little bit more patience with them to kind of explain and work through things.
I like to compare critter a lot to, and I hate to say it, but 50 Shades of Grey.
I'll hear you out.
While 50 Shades of Grey was not a true reality expectation of the BDSM kink community, it opened the doorway to a lot of people that had these hidden desires, that had the inability or the confidence to express that they had the idea of kink in the back of their head, and gave them the ability to learn some of our language, to come out to some of these things, and to make the connections to teach them the right way. And as a critter, we're very, very similar. We are more approachable than the heavily leathered dom muscle man with the floggers and whips and paddles, or the dominatrix with the knives and all of this, or the boy that's on his knees sitting beside and can't make eye contact. We have an approachability factor to reach out and do some, quote, muggle outreach, end quote, and embrace the idea of kink to these people that would never be able to reach out on their own.
It's interesting. So I've always, or I've often heard puppy play and critter play presented as like BDSM light, or the gateway drug into other forms of leather BDSM lifestyle. And it sounds to me like you're kind of saying the exact same thing applies to muggles, where we can be the gateway drug to understanding the rest of a gathered community or something.
It is definitely a gateway kink. Yeah. It is totally a gateway kink. I come from it completely opposite. I started off with the BDSM and leather, and Critter helped me expand what I was locked into with that community. So it helped me embrace my switch. It helped me realize that I could be multiple different things and wear multiple different titles. A lot of people are trying to find their way in which they're not necessarily all of a sudden tied down to a bed with random objects being slapped onto them and trying to figure out how to get out of it. They have the ability to observe. They have the ability to experiment. And they have the ability to go, oh, heck no, that's not my thing. And it's completely okay.
Or then there's, you know, people like me where we get in as a puppy and then we sit and stay and we're happy. And
and that's fine. Yep. And the thing is while the origin of puppy may have been more kink related and punishment for slaves, what it has evolved into is astounding, and it's amazing, because critter play has become the thing that for a decade, especially our local community's been trying to build, is, oh, you identify as a critter, you're welcome. It's not about your gender. It's not about your race. It's not about your sexual orientation. Hey, you're a critter. Come hang with us. We're going to have fun. Mm-hmm. And that's the excitement around critter that inspires me to keep moving forward with critter, inspires me to continue to keep educating, because we have this ability to show the rest of the BDSM kink, whether you're gay, whether you're pan, whether you're straight, whatever you classify as, that we can all come together with a common goal.
Whether you're a dog or a cat or a monkey or whatever, it just doesn't matter.
I have brought puppies into mosh pits. I have brought bunnies in the mosh pits. I have sent puppies chasing ponies. Like, we can all come together and have a good time.
Yep.
I have even seen a dolphin on a mosh pit. And there was a lot of squeaking and a lot of hilarity. But it was just one of those things. Yeah.
Y'all need to come to Tampa. Those of you who aren't in Tampa, we got it going on here.
And however these people may be visualizing a dolphin on land in the middle of a puppy mosh, trust me, it is 10 times more hysterical than anything you are currently visualizing.
Oh, geez. Good times. So let me use that as a transition point. You were just talking about, you know, your experience in moshes and such. And I've heard you say before that most of the time when you're around a public mosh, you, at this point in your path, walk, life, whatever word you want to use there, you often spend more of your time as a DM rather than as a participant on all fours in the mosh itself. You look like you already have something to say.
So I will be honest, I have only publicly moshed a handful of times. I could count on one hand the number of times I have publicly moshed.
Which is the definition of handful, so good. Yeah.
Right. Like, I was a pup for almost 4 years before I publicly moshed for the first time. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't a privacy thing or an intimidation thing. I just always lacked what I would call a trust in those that were DMing it. Because for those that don't know, dungeon monitoring or, you know, being there to corral the puppies and keep them on the mats, it is something in which very few people actually do correctly. We need a lot of interaction when we're in critter space for things like dehydration and sugar drops and injuries and boo-boos and sorry you can't come in with your spiked collar. And it's a very difficult thing to walk into a public mosh and immediately trust the person that's going to have your well-being when you see so many things going incorrectly already in a public mosh space.
So you just listed a number of things that people need to pay attention to, which is a great list.
And that's only a small amount of that list.
Right, right. another conversation for another time would be, here's exactly how to DM a mosh. Yeah. So a minute ago, you basically suggested that you would go up to a critter and give them that you know, choice between drink now, play more later, or play now, and then you're done. And you were saying that you basically explain that choice to them in full sentences, natural language, that sort of thing. Do you make any adjustments to the way you talk when you're DMing a mosh?
It depends. If they look at me and it's just kind of a really stunned look on their face, they know they're a little bit deeper in headspace. You have to read a lot of body language when you do that. You may just have to make it really, really simple. And I hate to say it, but take that choice away a little bit. And you just snap your fingers and go get water and boom, three words. So it depends upon the individual reaction. You've got to be able to judge how deep in headspace they are. You have to be able to read what energy they're giving back to you, whether it's verbal, whether it's physical. And it's really, really difficult because you also have to try, if they come in with a handler, not step on their handler's toes when you do this. Mm-hmm. But you also have to realize that ultimately, if you're the one monitoring this, the buck stops with you. And so sometimes you have to upset their dynamic to go, I'm trying to protect everybody in this moment. Mm-hmm. They need to take 5 minutes, or you need to step in and pull them off the mat when I've said something.
Because we're about to have a problem in the mosh.
But if they go down, it ruins the mosh for everybody, potentially for the rest of the mosh. We just have to publicly state this is not acceptable or this is what needs to happen. And if you want to play on our mats, you need to follow this.
So you talked a little bit about reading the body language of the critter to determine how far into headspace they are and that sort of thing. And we were talking previously about the need to keep in mind how far someone is into headspace and, you know, using simple language if they're trying to dive deep into it. And I think you just reiterated that, where if someone is in headspace, they're not going to be able to understand what you're saying. And so it sounds to me like part of the challenge of asking questions of critters is understanding, is figuring out how to ask the question in the first place. And it's reading the critter before you even say something to them to know how you're supposed to word your question, phrase your question, and what your goal needs to be. You mentioned like sometimes removing some of the choice to be a little bit more directive.
I think it's also, and especially for those that are beginning out, to remember we have multiple senses. So while verbally they may not be understanding, they may be able to understand you pointing a finger. They may be able to understand a touch. There are multiple senses that you can use to get your point across to somebody who's potentially in headspace. And think about it like a biological dog. While they may not respond to you immediately going sit, you may snap your fingers, do the sit command, and boom, they pop in that position. So sometimes you have to change gears mid-track, and that's perfectly fine. I've been a critter for a decade now, and Jesus Christ, I've been critter for a decade now.
You're old.
Word. And I still have to change gears because it's not just how far into headspace they are. You have to look at potential language barriers. Is English their first language? Is Spanish their first language? You have to look at, are they an introvert? Are they an extrovert? You have to look at, are they new into the community? Have they been in the community for a length of time? There's a lot of factors that go in. You're not going to immediately have an interaction with a new critter and get it right the first time.
Yeah.
I've been doing this for a while, and I rarely get it right the first time.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to be willing to go to the next form of communication, and that's not a bad thing. That's really actually a good thing. You're willing to go, this didn't work, what works?
Yeah, and I think the important thing is just to remember that there are those options there, and that, you know, try other ones if the first one that you tried didn't work. Don't like insist on it and keep trying the same thing.
It talking louder to a deaf person doesn't work. It doesn't help them hear. And so if your verbal communication isn't working, find another form. And sometimes it may mean even going, hey, is your handler here, and seeing if their handler pipes up, or is your pack here? A lot of, especially in public areas, pups don't go alone.
Mm-hmm.
And you will probably find somebody there who can help you find what I call that Rosetta Stone,
mm-hmm.
that ability to translate and get the communication on the same path,
mm-hmm.
and see how they react to somebody they already know. It could just be you're a complete stranger and they're not going to listen to you. And that's fine. Safety first,
right.
Safety second, safety third type deal.
Yep. Okay. So, we've just talked about how to negotiate as a DM with someone who's involved in a mosh. How do negotiations differ when we're dealing with a smaller or a more personal or a more private scene than a public mosh like that?
Well, I think you have to, it's kind of like negotiating with a BDSM scene. You have to find out what the goal is. What's the end intent? And it breaks down to, is this going to be sexual? Is this going to be non-sexual? Is this going to be playful? Is this going to be a little bit rougher? You have to both kind of be on the same page for what the end intent is. With that being said, if it's somebody that you are privately moshing with for the first time, I don't recommend starting off in headspace. I recommend in both starting off in mm-hmm. a human headspace
mm-hmm.
so that you can figure that out mm-hmm. before you start on the mats or on the floor or in the bedroom or wherever you're going to do it. I think it's important that everybody knows the same end goal.
Yeah.
And be willing to go, this may change.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I pointed out, I think it was in the previous episode, was my recommendation is generally having two people, having all of the people involved in a scene in headspace simultaneously is, in my opinion, a bad idea because it eliminates a safety valve where if you have at least one person who is still a fully functional human, there's that ability to try and help a little bit more actively if something goes wrong.
Well, I also think it's kind of impossible for everyone to snap in headspace at the same time, too. So if everybody starts off in human, you're going to have people in various levels of headspace getting there, and then you're going to have some people getting out of headspace quicker than others. I think that's an impossible expectation to believe that everyone's going to snap their fingers and pop in headspace at the same time,
mm-hmm.
and then everyone's going to snap their fingers and pop out of headspace at the same time. And if anybody's expecting that, more power to you, but be prepared for disappointment.
Newsflash. Yep. Okay, so let's see here. I've often heard you talk about negotiations with humans that you say critters are obligated to initiate, even while they are actively in headspace. And I think this is something that I've heard very few, if any, other people talk about. The idea that a critter in headspace should be cognizant enough and aware enough to know that a negotiation is necessary and to know how to start a negotiation. That isn't something I'm used to hearing about. So could you talk for a bit about your thoughts on these basically imperative, obligated, obligatory, there's the word I want, obligatory negotiations initiated by the critter?
So I think what we need to do is, first of all, remember that we're going to an animalistic-like headspace. So if you think like you own a bio dog, you're not going to let that bio dog immediately run up to a complete stranger and jump in their lap and demand cuddles and scritches and all these things. You're going to control that situation a bit as a bio dog owner. And after a certain point, if you're consistent enough with a bio dog doing this, they will stop on their own before running up to a stranger. They will sit. They will wait for that stranger to either initiate scritches or back away if they're intimidated by a bio dog or whatever. We need to remember that while we are imitating, we are still human. And while...
Scandalous. How dare you?
I'm going to say something that I have been yelled at before for. If you get so far into headspace that you completely forget you are human, you need to seek mental health professionals. I am not saying coming out of critter headspace is not difficult when you are deep. But the reality of the fact is at the end of the day, you are still human. You were never a biological dog or cat, or insert other critter here. You will never be a biological dog or cat and insert other critter here. At the end of the day, you are still human. You still have that human mindset. Now, while it may be suppressed, while you may be embracing your critter side, if that human aspect completely 100% disappears, there is a reason for it. Mm-hmm. And it could be trauma related, it could be mental health related, but you need to get down to the crux of that. I am not saying you can't be critter. Mm-hmm. I am not saying that you are sick. I am saying that there is a trigger there or something else going on that needs professional help. Mm-hmm. You can still be a critter and have a mental health disorder. Mm-hmm. You can still be a critter and have issues. It's perfectly acceptable. We all have them. Mm-hmm. We're just a little bit more upfront about it. But what critter becomes is a scary, uncontrollable coping mechanism for somebody who may not be dealing with their issues. And that is when really scary things happen, when they can't snap out of headspace mm-hmm. and protect themselves. Mm-hmm. And that is when you hear a lot of these stories about critters that were hurt and they couldn't pull themselves out of headspace. And I've been snapped out of headspace. I'm sure you've been snapped out of headspace. And yeah, it sucks. But at the end of the day, it's there to protect you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it might sting mentally for a minute, but that's far better than whatever the consequence would be if I had stayed in.
Right. So remembering all of that, we still have that human aspect in there to know, I don't know this person, or I've had very few communications with this person, and critters aren't going to necessarily run up to a stranger and put their head in their lap. Mm-hmm. When you're at an event, they're not going to run up to a stranger and put their nose in their crotch or start humping their leg. And if they do, that's completely unacceptable behavior because permission hasn't been granted. And quite frankly, I don't know what you got. I don't want ticks and fleas. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. we need to remember that while we are enjoying this space, people coming into it in a public setting are also wanting to enjoy the space. So I believe public consent is something that we need to remember. Now, that being said, if they walk up to a mosh pit, and it is a mosh pit at the time and not a bar night, and they walk up, they have consented for the critters to walk up to them and sniff them and want to play with them.
That's true.
It works both ways. If they knowingly walk up to a critter space that is currently in active critter mode and it's puppies and kitties and they're on the mosh mat, they've consented to interact. But if they're sitting on a bar stool on the opposite side of an area and a critter runs up and puts their head in their lap, they haven't consented to that.
Yeah, so I'm now imagining the large public moshes that I've seen at events like IML and MAL and such, where there's a huge, huge mat area and a whole bunch of people gathered around the edges as spectators. And now that you say that, it's pretty obvious which among the spectators are people who are familiar with what's going on and which of them aren't. The ones who are familiar and comfortable with the interaction style and such are the ones who are going to get closer to the mats and make themselves physically available for that interaction. And then the people who have no freaking clue what's going on, they're going to have a barrier of several people in between them and that mat because they need that protection as much as we do to be able to try and figure out what the hell's happening.
Think about it. The first event you went to or anybody's gone to, when you first go to an event, you don't sit front row. Mm-hmm. You sit towards the back. You're not immediately on top of a scene. Mm-hmm. You're a little bit far away from it. And while you may be observing and you may be interested, you may have questions, you still need that safe distance to give that air of protection. And it's up to those that are more experienced or more comfortable to recognize that and, you know, maybe afterwards walk up and go, hey, did you have any questions? Or I saw you watching, you looked interested. But remember that you need to do that more as a human state and a more as approachable state and not necessarily just running and throwing your butt in the air at them and expecting them to sniff it and give it scritches.
And yeah, so that leads into the next question I wanted to ask. Something along the lines of, do you have any advice for how to handle the situation where we're in, say, a social or bar situation, a mixed environment, and we get approached by or confronted by muggles who, because they're not part of the community, they don't understand the importance or need for consent. They don't understand the norms of engagement and such. For instance, one of my pet peeves is having my tail yanked on whenever I'm in a bar, and people in the community know that that's a no-no, but people outside the community don't. And so they'll often just, you know, smack the tail or yank the tail or that sort of thing. I have my kind of scripted reaction to that, but I'm curious if you've got suggestions or advice on how critters should handle it when other folks violate our accepted norms of consent.
So I think it's really important to, first of all, look at the context of where you're at. Mm-hmm. If you're in a bar and they're drunk, it doesn't matter what your script is going to be. If they're super drunk, they're just going to be jerks, and you're going to have to realize that, recognize that. You may have to get the bar staff involved or get a group of people involved, but unless they are just absolutely inebriated, I kind of deal with a 3-strike rule. I'm very, very polite the first time, like, please don't touch. You don't touch things that aren't yours. Don't pull my tail. Second time, I'm a lot more firm and a little borderline rude. Like, I've already told you once, don't touch. Third strike, you're out. I become see you next Tuesday, and I am full on puppy, ready to, like, I told you not to touch. You are done. You need to walk to the other side of the bar. If you come near me again, you're going to wind up getting hurt. Mm-hmm. So I kind of handle it with a 3-strike rule, you know, very polite, then to firm, then to I'm flat out rude because you've been rude and that's what you deserve.
And anyone who knows the two of us knows that I don't necessarily get to that point like you do. I don't become as assertive as you do. And so, like, in the interest of me adding a little bit of balance to the conversation, I do want to bring it back to the way you started your response, which was remember the context. And it sounds to me like your suggestion is basically, if you're in a bar environment, and it's specifically if it's not a critter night or something like that, if you're in a bar environment, we're kind of on their turf rather than the other way around. We might be having an event there. We might be among our friends there. But if I go to a human bar that is designed for humans and serving human drinks, and I handed somebody a credit card to get a drink or what have you, it's their space, and I'm a guest there, rather than the other way around. And so starting with that polite explanation, I think is absolutely essential, because otherwise we're making expectations of them that are unfair.
I completely agree. If they don't know, how are they supposed to know?
Right.
you know, we're coming into what you just classified as their space. And while a lot of them are completely curious and accepting of it, they're never going to understand, no matter how polite you are or how many times you explain it or how good you are at articulating what's going on. They're never going to understand. And that's okay. And that's acceptable. When they come into our turf, it's a different story. Mm-hmm. They need to understand, or they need to at least be able to fake respect for what's going on. Mm-hmm. And taking that into context happens to take a lot of the burden off the individual critter for an expectation that's unrealistic. While you personally may be a little bit shyer or more polite about the situation for longer, and I have a 3-strike rule, we've also got to remember that most of the time when we're doing a bar night or something like that, we're not alone.
Yeah.
There are others of us there. And if you are in a situation that is uncomfortable, please, by all means, find the loudmouth, find the person that is a big personality, find the people that are kind of not taking crap off of anybody or having a good time, and you see them there, and even just stand behind them. You don't necessarily have to get the nerve up to walk up to them and introduce yourself and go, I'm having a situation. Just standing behind them a lot of the times helps solve the issue, because now those other people have to walk by that big personality or that loud mouth, mm-hmm. and they'll get intimidated as well by it, or have to walk through a group of pups to go pick on one individually. And usually they'll just pick on the closest one to them, which usually then ends up being the loudmouth who has a 3-strike rule, who's going to put them in their place really quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I don't think I'd ever thought through like what I would have to do if I got into an awkward situation, because it just, fortunately, it hasn't happened. Anytime that I've had a muggle walk up and, you know, yank tail, swat tail, whatever, I just take that as interest, turn around and turn it into what my human side calls a teachable moment. And I just start explaining, you know, this is what the tail is, and this is why what you just did doesn't work. And every time I've had that conversation, it's always turned out well. People have been interested and either rolled their eyes and left me alone, or continued asking questions, and it turned into a great conversation. But now that you pointed out, if I ever had problems, you're right. Walking over and standing behind you would probably be a great idea, because I know that if anything happens near you, you would not hesitate to give somebody a piece of your mind. And even if I didn't specifically tell you, hey, Topher, I need you to kind of run interference for me, it would probably happen anyway, because you'll just watch.
You'll usually notice the people that are very, very social and loud are constantly have their head on a pivot.
Yep.
They're scanning the room, and it's not necessarily a fear factor, but they may look at you and go, hey, why don't you join us for the conversation, or hi, or whatever, and all of a sudden now you're included in the group. While you may not actively participate, they've acknowledged you, and then they're also a little bit more aware of situations that may occur with you. And a lot of extroverts, believe it or not, are actually really good at reading body language. You can usually tell when somebody's uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And while I may not be the one to approach you and go, hey, you look really, really uncomfortable, I have a great family and pack. I have a great community in which I may send, like for you, I would send my husband Master Shadow and go, hey, something's up with Akis, go check on him. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden now you have that person there of going, listen, I'm really, really uncomfortable right now, or I don't want to talk about it, can we just stand here a moment? And you have that option to then communicate or not communicate, whatever you wish to do, but get you out of that situation and know that you're still being included and protected and loved, and you are part of the community.
So I think the moral of the story here is, if we are in a social environment where we aren't in headspace, we're just among our people, and we get into a situation where our consent has not been secured before something happens, the best option for us is to reach out to trusted members of the community to get them to help intervene.
Even if you have to reach out to a complete stranger, and I know it is super difficult to reach out to somebody you don't know, but if you're new to the area, if you're by yourself, just lift your head up and look and see those that are there. Also remember, like, the bar staff is there, and if you tip them well, they are going to look out for you. And you may have to go, hey, who runs this thing, to the bar staff, or, you know, who put this together? I'd like to buy them a drink. And then you have a little bit, now you have a name and an individual that you can walk up to, little things like that that can help protect you before you potentially get into headspace or before a potential situation may occur. And it's really good to build a community right then and there. Like, who put this together? Oh, that guy did. Great. I'm going to bring him a bottled water and find out if he wants another beverage. And now you've introduced yourself to somebody and you're building that rapport so that if something doesn't happen, you may have a new friend.
Yeah. Yep. I've heard you use the phrase socially violated before, which isn't a phrase that I'm familiar with, or I'm used to hearing, like, outside of, well, earshot of you. Could you explain what that concept is and maybe even what it looks like when it happens, or why we should be aware of what social violation is?
So I see it, you can see it in a lot of different respects. It's really, really common in the critter and little community to see it a little bit more often. And basically they include people in their dynamic that they haven't talked with. So they'll run up to the stranger sitting at the bar and put their head in their lap. They'll run up and start, you know, humping somebody's leg or biting them, and all of a sudden, here you are, and you've got this stranger you've never met before, and they are forcing you into their dynamic and their play, and you don't know anything about them. You don't know their name. You don't know what they're looking for. And so it winds up being this really common, uncomfortable situation for everybody involved, except the critter who's kind of forcing it at the time because they don't realize that they're doing something wrong.
So social violation is the consequence of critters who don't initiate that that consent negotiation while they're in headspace that we just talked about.
That is exactly it. I mean, no matter what goes on, it's kind of that, what is consent? That's that emphatic yes. We've re-termed consent is no longer a lack of no to it's an emphatic yes. Mm-hmm. And if you're not getting that, then you are violating somebody in some way. Whether it's sexual or not doesn't matter. When you've immersed yourself in somebody's personal space, we're seeing this really well right now in the current political climate with, quote, social distancing, end quote.
We're
looking at this aspect of our personal space, our personal protection bubble keeps us healthy and well. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of the same aspect when you're dealing with outside influences that you don't necessarily know. That social bubble, you've got to be able to invite people in, or they've now violated it. And while, yeah, it may not, when all of this is over, give you COVID, it may make you feel uncomfortable, not feel welcome, not want to come back. It may interrupt a very important conversation you're having. It's very, very common for a lot of us at these events to get into very deep conversations with people that they've just lost a family member, or they're dealing with a history of drug abuse and they're trying not to relapse, or their medications aren't right for whether it's a medical or mental health issue. It's really, really common for us to get into these conversations in private, and where if it was a human walking up, you would give them the finger one moment, like, let me finish this, I will get with you. But when they're a critter and they're not necessarily paying attention and they run up, they're now not only violating your consent by putting their head in your lap or demanding scritches or barking or whatever the case may be, they're now violating this privacy moment with this other person you were having a conversation with. That is something that could lead to a very negative result for that individual.
And I think it's especially important. It's good that you brought up the nature of the conversations we often have and the fact that those conversations can take place in the middle of a bar, like spaces where those deep, intimate, important conversations traditionally don't happen. In our community, We seem to have no, like, I have discussed mental health medications in the middle of a bar while there's dance music playing in the background, because with the person I was chatting, that was important to both of us at the moment, and we cared about each other's health, and so questions were asked, conversations were had. And so the simple, air quotes here, the simple act of interrupting somebody in the middle of a conversation in a bar isn't simple in this environment, because it's so easy for us to have those different conversations.
I think it's important we also remember our queer heritage and roots as well. The LGBT plus bars were at one time our only safe spaces. This is where we found other people like us. This is where we found people that could understand where we came from. And we started entire movements in bars. Mm-hmm. We had the deep conversations in bars. We started political rallies in bars. We fundraised in bars. We did things for the entire community out of the bars. And we move forward to now of an internet generation of Grindr and Scruff and ChristianMingle.com and all these things that...
You're on that one too.
We get that moment for a one-on-one, in-person interaction. We can have those serious conversations that we could never have in text, because we need to understand the emotion and energy of that moment. And you don't get that with something in writing. Mm-hmm. You don't know, hey, I need to talk. I need a doctor recommendation. Could actually mean I've been up for the past 3 nights thinking about suicide, but you can get that in a one-on-one conversation when they go, listen, I need to see a doctor. I've been very, very depressed lately. You can get that in person. And believe it or not, the number of times that has happened, mm-hmm. whether it is substance abuse, whether it is eating disorder, whether it is mental health, whether it is a freaking heart palpitation and they're having cardiac issues, it before COVID and all of that, it was probably about once a month mm-hmm. when you would get into super serious conversations and all of a sudden you realize that they're trying to close the bar because it's been shut down for 20 minutes and the bar staff hasn't wanted to interrupt you with the conversation.
Mm-hmm. And the other side of it was, if a critter is in headspace, they are by definition engaged in a scene, and anyone engaged in a scene has to consent to that scene.
And 100%.
So if a critter in headspace walks up to a human who's standing there having a conversation, they are imposing their scene, their active scene, on someone who wasn't present for negotiations, who didn't know that the scene was going on, who hadn't been invited into the scene. And the critter has to keep that in mind and has to engage in appropriate negotiations.
And I think it's actually not that difficult for the critter to do. It's just like when you're waiting, you see a couple of people, they're talking and you're wanting to greet somebody, and you hold a couple of feet back and you just kind of stand there and wait to be acknowledged. Wait to see if they acknowledge you in your critter space, and also wait to see how they acknowledge you when you're in your critter space. Do they all, hey puppy, you want scritches? Do they automatically initiate? Because once they go, do you want scritches? They're now negotiating with you mm-hmm. for a scene. Mm-hmm. If they go, hey, how are you? They're speaking to you as a human. Either A, they don't know what the heck is going on, or B, they're not consenting to a critter scene at the moment. Mm-hmm. And that is your chance to basically either walk away or come out of it, or mm-hmm. just kind of be like, wag your tail and go, what the heck, man? I want scritches. But you're still giving everybody the opportunity to consent without them going, I consent for you to come up, pup.
You let them find a way to say those words in scene.
Right.
In whatever scene it is they are willing to engage. That makes good sense. So I've run out of all of my questions. Is there something that you wish I had asked you that you haven't been asked, or something that's like bugging you that you want to chat about?
I think one of the things that is not talked about a whole lot is it's two parts. One, it is okay for any party to end a scene. It is not necessarily that something has gone on bad or wrong. It could be their own mental health state. It could be their physical. They could just be hungry. It is okay for anybody to end a scene at any time, and we need to respect that, but we also need to be willing to end it ourselves if need be. That being said, part B is we also need to realize that we can renegotiate a scene within the scene itself. Sometimes things take a twist or a turn, or you realize that, hey, things are progressing in a different direction. And it's not necessarily sexual, but yes, sexual can be a part of it. But what may have just started off as we're roughhousing has now turned into puppy cuddles, and or it could go in a sexual direction. But we need to be willing to renegotiate within the scene. And it may, if it's something that's a little bit more intimate and personal sexually, we may need to come out of headspace and go back into headspace later on. But if it's just the play type changing, we can still stay in headspace and do that. It doesn't mean because beforehand we sat down and going, okay, A, B, and C is the goals. These are the things we're going to do. This is the outcome I want. And then you're 20 minutes into it and it has totally changed, that the scene has gone wrong.
So it sounds to me like one of the things the critter has to learn or figure out before diving into headspace is what requests look like to that critter while in the scene. Because I'm hearing you say that scenes can be renegotiated in the middle, you know, if things are changing from one form to another. Knowing what it looks like for me as a puppy to ask you if it's okay for me to do something, I have to know what that looks like. I have to figure that out. I can't just like spontaneously discover that because I might not do it right. I have to put some thought into that before I jump into headspace.
And don't expect to know that if it's your first time in headspace or you're very new to pupping out. This is a progression that happens over time. Mm-hmm. From every instance, we learn more, the good and the bad. We progress both as human beings, but as our critter persona, as fetishists, we learn from every encounter we have. Mm-hmm. And while this mid-scene negotiation may have been a total bomb and everything messed up and we end up just giggling on the floor completely out of critter space, we can take from that and learn. And then the next critter scene that we have, it'll progress easier and more natural. Just like a biological puppy growing up, they're going to learn from their previous mistakes. That I don't potty here. I wait and go outside to potty. The little
do
things,
you though? Do
like,
you really?
Okay. Sometimes. Listen, if they consent.
And
and see. But we learn from every encounter we have, and the puppy I was 10 years ago and the puppy I am today are nowhere near the same puppy.
Mm-hmm. Right, because the other one was 10 years younger. We established that.
You're for welcome. Those at home, I'm clicking off.
There it is. I had to work hard for that one.
But it's not just that it was 10 years younger. I learned how to communicate better as a puppy. I learned how to communicate better with puppies. Mm-hmm. I learned how to definitely communicate a lot better with handlers of other people's puppies. Mm-hmm. I've learned a lot of different techniques over time that have made the experience go smoother and have made negotiations go easier, have made both verbal and nonverbal communications get the idea across a lot quicker and easier for all parties.
Yep. Sounds good. So next time you drop into headspace, be a good, well-trained pup, and remember to get consent from every participant before engaging in any scene. It's the polite, ethical, safe thing to do. Thanks for listening to The Dog Dish, and special thanks to Topher Chandler, a.k.a. Fuck You Topher, a.k.a. Mama's Pup Otter, for barking at me for this episode. We'll hear more from Topher. Yeah, like no one's ever said that before. Wait a second, didn't I say that exact same thing last time? Dang it, Topher. Anyway, we'll hear more from him in a future episode about how to DM a mosh. But in the meantime, our next episode will be about hierarchy in the puppy community. It's another class discussion from last year's Florida Power Exchange, and this one aims to deliberately push a few buttons, or poke a few bears, or tug a few tails, whatever metaphor works for you. And one more thing, I'm committed to making the Dog Dish accessible to everyone. I make sure the show's website works with screen readers for folks with vision difficulty, and I get each episode's audio transcribed for those who can't easily hear them. Web hosting and transcriptions don't come cheap, with each episode running about $45 to $60 to produce. If you enjoy the show, if you enjoy these conversations and want to keep them coming, if these episodes help you feel connected in times of isolation, please help support the show's production. Imagine if you and I had these chats in a bar and you'd say, "Let me buy you a drink." Consider sending that along to make sure everyone everywhere can benefit from these discussions. Just follow the Becoming a Patron link at the top of the page at dogdishshow.com or go to pupacus.square.site. Thanks for helping out. So that's it for this episode. Now go train your favorite podcast player to fetch so you'll hear the next episode once it's released. Or you can visit dogdishshow.com for all the episodes, for more information about the show, and to get in touch. But until then, you stay. Stay tuned for more, that is. Arf!